From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The L.A. Teachers Union's holding a news conference this hour on its dispute with L.A. Unified. There's been little progress in negotiations, and the union could choose to strike following winter break. If you're an LAUSD parent, teacher, or student, I'd like to hear how you deal with a possible strike. Please call us at 866-893-5722. Now the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such pleasure to have you with us. Hope your day's going well. Coming up, LAPD Chief Michael Moore's regular visit, and we'll look at stepped-up speed limit enforcement and speed limit increases on some L.A. streets, as well as other topics. But first, parents of L.A. Unified students might find themselves in a jam after the current winter break, perhaps dealing with a teacher's strike. Right now, the union, United Teachers Los Angeles, is holding a news conference about its ongoing dispute with the district. Given the comments yesterday from union president Alex Caputo-Pearl, sounds more likely that teachers will walk. Caputo-Pearl heavily criticized Superintendent Austin Buettner over yesterday's district claim UTLA had agreed to the salary increases suggested by neutral fact finders. Caputo-Pearl called the claim a stunt. Fact finders recommended a 3% retroactive raise to mid-2017 and a further 3% increase effective as of last July 1st. Setting aside the salary dispute, UTLA also wants additional nurses, counselors, and librarians, along with smaller classes. But I'd like to hear from you. If you're a parent, if you're an LA Unified teacher, if you're an administrator, if you're a student, how are you expecting to deal with the potential of a strike? Now, again, it might not happen. The union has not announced that it's going to walk out. It has taken a strike authorization vote. It is poised to do so. But my question for you is, if a strike is called, how will you cope with that? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me is Seth Litt, Executive Director of Parent Revolution, a former public school principal in New York. Seth, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Larry.
So how do you anticipate parents responding to this if the teachers go on strike?
Well, we work with public school families here in Los Angeles, and families really do rely on schools for many things, for nutrition, for making sure their children are safe during the day, and most of all, for making sure their children have the type of opportunities that they deserve in their lives. You know, right now, 38% of Los Angeles' children are graduating from high school ready for college. There's a real crisis of learning, and I think above and beyond anything else, families are really worried about a tremendous interruption to their children's opportunity to learn and to move forward and to make progress.
All right. And if the schools stay open, if administrators fill in, and again, we don't know what happened, but do you anticipate that most children would still go to school, or do you think significant numbers would keep their kids home if their teachers aren't in the classroom?
I think whether or not children are sent to school is a family-by-family decision, depending on their individual circumstances. But again, we know that one thing is for sure, that education and learning will be incredibly disrupted by this, as it already has been, as a lot of the energy of the city and of schools and of all of us has been sort of taken away by this conversation, not the conversation about whether or not we're educating children in Los Angeles. And I think that families understand that even if their children go to school during a potential strike, they will not be in classes, they will not be learning, and will not be ready for the next grade or ready for college or ready for high school.
And do you think that parents have been represented at all in this process, or is that appropriate at all for parental voices, or is this strictly a straight labor issue between teachers and administration?
Well, I think that two of the most important voices in education are not represented in these negotiations, and those are the voices of families and the voices of students. I think families have been incredibly disappointed that many of the core issues about how children are educated in Los Angeles have not been part of the negotiation points of either side in this negotiation, and that families have been totally shut out of this process.
We're talking with Seth Litt, executive director of the group Parent Revolution. He professionally was a public school principal in New York. Again, I'd like to hear from you. If you have a child in LA Unified, if you're a student in LA Unified, if you teach in the district, if you're an administrator in LA Unified, I welcome your input on if there is a strike, if that happens. Again, we don't know if that's going to happen or not, but if it does, then how will you respond to it? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let me bring into the conversation Sam in Eagle Rock. I understand you're an LAUSD parent. Three kids go to elementary school in Eagle Rock. Sam, if there is a strike, how is your family going to deal with it?
Thanks for having me, Larry. If there's a strike, we're going to do our best to support the teachers and try to hold our kids out of school. But that gets tricky because my wife and I both work full time. And so we're already strategizing to try to think about how we can make it happen. We have parents who might be able to come in from out of town and help out. We might be able to hire someone on a short-term basis. And we've been talking to other families to try and see if there's ways we can share childcare responsibilities, but it's going to be tricky.
All right. So you support the union position on this, or is it just in principle you don't want to cross the picket line if there is one?
It's a little bit of both. So it does, you know, in general, we'd like to see more resources devoted to the schools, but we would also try not to cross the picket line if we're able to make it happen.
All right. I thank you very much. I appreciate your being with us. That's Sam, who is a parent of three kids in Eagle Rock School in LA Unified. Again, if you're a parent, teacher, student, administrator within LA Unified, I'd like to hear how you're intending to respond if there is a strike, because if the school district calls for it, if the union calls for it, the school district's going to have to quickly make contingency plans to how to deal with that. And parents are going to have to decide if the schools stay open, how they're going to deal with it. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jeanette in Echo Park, how are you going to deal with it if there is a strike?
Hi. Well, myself and all the teachers at my school are planning to strike.
Okay.
And I have a daughter. My daughter's in fifth grade, so I'm not going to be sending her in to, like, sit in the auditorium and watch movies all day. She's just going to get a social studies lesson and, like, strike with us.
Well, she's foreign. She has a teacher in-house, so she's prepared. Jeanette, to your knowledge, are there any non-UTLA members, faculty members at your school?
There might be a couple who are, like, TAs.
But pretty much all the fully accredited teachers are UTLA members where you teach?
Yes.
All right. So they're obviously going to be out on the lines then. And what would you anticipate? You think the district would still keep the schools open and just use administrators on campuses?
Yeah, I think that's what the plan is, to just have the administrator and maybe send some office people from Beaudry to help back up our principal. I don't know.
All right. Jeanette, thanks so much. She's both a teacher and a mother of a fifth grade daughter who she'll have out protesting with her out on the picket lines if there is a strike. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. John in the San Fernando Valley says, I'm a special education elementary school teacher in the district. I've already made my signs to go out out and picket. LAUSD has its own TV station. It wastes a lot of money on materials that it purchases and ends up dumping. It isn't just underpaying teachers. It mismanages money. That's John in the San Fernando Valley. Dave in West Hollywood says, I'm a parent of kids in LA Unified. I'm not going to cross a picket line. It's time the teachers get paid more. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Canoga Rich writes, I'm a high school teacher. LAUSD isn't addressing our deeper student-centric needs. Reduction in class size, which is a salary issue. More students equals more extracurricular work. Hiring nurses, counselors, and librarians, and removing Codicil 1.5, which allows the district to arbitrarily impose financial sanctions. We teachers aren't simply about the money, or we would have settled for the phony 6%, which is actually 3+3, the second half contingent upon LAUSD fuzzy accounting. This deal doesn't address anything students really need. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Patty in Monterey Park, if UTLA strikes, what are your plans?
Hey, hi, Larry. I'm definitely going to strike. I wanted to say I'm a 21-year teacher. I'm also a parent of an LAUSD kid, and I was a student back in the 89 strike. Personally, my son is going to go the first day of school, but after that, he's striking with me because I remember in 89, they had all of us in the library. They had us in the auditorium with one or two adult supervisions, hundreds of kids. I'm not going to put my kid through that kind of danger. I wanted to say, too, just on the side, the gentleman from, Parent Revolution. Parent Revolution is a creature of Green Dot, so I would take anything he said with a grain of salt because that's part of what we're fighting for, what the charters have done to our schools, the brain drain that has resulted, the kids that are being pulled out because and they're not being therefore supported by our district. I did want to say, too, that as far as income, I work with student teachers at Cal State LA and Mount St. Mary's. They've had a massive drop in the amount of teachers that are in their programs because nobody wants to be a teacher anymore. Apart from the way the public looks at our profession, the income, it's just so much work that they're asking us to do for the amount that they're paying us. I agree with the previous person who wrote that we're not doing it because of the money. We would have settled by now.
Yeah.
My school, I teach at an inner city school. So many of our kids are having emotional, socio-emotional problems, but there's one psychosocial worker for 2,200 kids.
So, Patty, let me ask you, the neutral fact finder came back with a report. It sounds like you think your union should not accept what the fact finders recommended. Is that correct?
I'm not familiar with all the details yet. I'm waiting for UTLA to make a formal announcement. I know the report that was given out by Buettner, he said we had agreed to the raise, but as far as I've heard, we have not. So I don't really have a comment. I just
okay.
Do know that it's not about the money.
All right, Patty, I thank you very much. Both in LA, or I should actually say all three, past LAUSD student, currently parent of LAUSD student, and a teacher in the district as well. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. I'd like to hear from you if you are affiliated with LA Unified in any way, a parent, a teacher, an administrator, a student. No, students out too. I'd love to hear a student voice. If you're currently going to school in an LA Unified school, what do you think? And you know, would you still be okay with going to school if a strike is called or not? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Carla in Lakewood, how are you planning to handle a strike if there is one?
Hi, Larry. Hi, I'm Carla, and I'm actually a psychiatric social worker, so we are also under UTLA. And I think one of the things that we don't recognize is that a lot of these kids do need social-emotional support. So I am going to be able to, hopefully, by striking, to show that that's what some of these kids do need, social-emotional support.
All right. And your thoughts about what the neutral fact finders came back with. And I believe their proposal was to take $30 million as a fund for hiring additional people in a district the size of LA Unified. That's not going to go very far. But
it's not. I think it really isn't. And again, it's not just teachers. We need psychiatric social workers. We need attendance counselors. We need nurses. At my school, I'm there 4 days out of the week, but I have to service more than 200 students who need that social emotional support. And so $30 million is not enough to cover what these students really need.
All right. I appreciate it, Carla. Thanks very much. We have more calls to come as we get your thoughts about the future of LA Unified. Right now, UTLA, the union representing teachers, as well as others, like our last guest, who provide additional services to students, making a major announcement about its response to the fact-finding yesterday, to statements that LA Unified has made over the past 24 hours. We may even get word as to whether there will be a strike called for after the winter break. That's unclear at this point. But in case there is a strike called, I want to know what sorts of plans you're making. If you're a parent, teacher, administrator, or a student, we'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. If you're a parent of LA Unified students, if you are a student in the district and out on break, if you're an administrator, a teacher, how are you going to handle a potential strike? UTLA holding its news conference right now. Our reporter Kyle Stokes is there. Just as soon as we get the word of what the union's announcing, we'll bring it to you live right here on 89.3. But we're looking down the road. If a strike is called and if the union stays off the job after the winter break, the question is, how are you going to adapt to that? Because obviously that's going to put a lot of stress on all the different stakeholders here. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Joseph in Glendale, I understand you teach in the district?
Yeah, I've taught in the district for 13 years.
Yeah, how are you going to deal with this?
Well, I'm in a unique position of actually opposing this strike for a number of reasons, and it's really disappointing the way UTLA has handled this whole situation. They really seem to be pretty intellectually dishonest when it comes to the district's finances. They don't want to recognize that there is a long-term budget problem. So when they say there's a $1.8 billion surplus or reserve, that's true right now. But when that money is already going to be used to pay off future deficits, it's not really a true surplus.
It's interesting. You're talking about the bargaining, good faith or not. LA Unified just released today a report claiming that the State of California Public Employee Relations Board, which oversees the negotiation, has issued a complaint against UTLA for refusing to bargain in good faith. According to the district, the Public Employment Relations Board says teachers have twice altered their positions on what they are negotiating for. The complaint, a copy of that, was released by LAUSD that one day after the neutral fact finders came back in support of a 3% increase retroactive to July 1st of last year and another 3% that was to be retroactive to July 1st of this year. So anyway, that's the latest on it. So, Joseph, you think that the union has not been straight about what's your major complaint along that? You think they're just not being honest about the district's financial condition?
I think that the strike is really for UTLA about essentially an elaborate protest against Austin Buettner, against charter schools. And I understand those issues. Austin Buettner has clearly lacks leadership skills. He has handled this very poorly. If we had someone in here like Ramon Cortinas, this would not have happened. Buettner does not know what to do in this situation. But Caputo Pearl has wanted a strike. He obviously wants a strike. the union, they lie about things constantly. Like this notion that we're 46th in the country in state spending, that's just objectively false.
Well, there are obviously many different ways of ranking that. Joseph, I appreciate it. Thank you very much. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Steve in Encino. Steve, you're an LAUSD parent. What are your plans if there's a strike?
This is a teaching moment for my son. This is the first chance he has, being 14, to be involved in activism. Where do you stand, my son? Do you stand with your teachers, or do you have another agenda that you wish to pursue? And because we've been active in school ever since they've been in kindergarten, so we know all the teachers and all the complaints throughout the years, and we are encouraging him to make a stance.
All right. And it is a teaching moment. This makes me recall my middle school years at LeConte Junior High School in Hollywood. There was a dispute then between UTLA and the district. We're going back to the 1970s. And I remember my teacher in class, in my social studies class, you know, talking about their dispute with the district, and became a big, you know, topic in the conversation. Although, because I was a total, you know, public policy nerd kid, even in middle school, read the paper every day and knew about the issues in the strike. And so I was kind of pushing back on the teacher and her, the way she was presenting the issue. And she didn't like that too much in class. So, Steve, you have to be careful how your kids frame this in the classroom. Stephen Encino, 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Tom, in Northridge, how are you going to handle this if UTLA calls a strike?
Well, I think I'm going to keep my middle schooler home. I've been really disgusted with how the LAUSD has treated children in general. My kid's school is an onion. It's a honors within a magnet, within a charter, and there's just too many kids in the classroom. There's 40 kids in each class, each of the academic classes, and it leads to sledgehammer discipline in the classroom and not enough supervision in the hallways, which leads to bullying. So for the reason of class size, as well as the fact that the teachers are grossly underpaid, yeah, I'm all in for the strike, and I'm keeping my kid home.
All right, Tom, I appreciate it. And so you have the resources to be able to have your kids or their middle school, and you feel like it's okay for them to be on their own during the day?
It's not ideal. I do trust my child to stay home alone, but obviously that's not sustainable over the long term. And, you know, between her mom and I, we'll have to figure out game plans between other parents and mutual kids' friends where we can kind of tag team parenting and supervision. But it's, you know, this has come to a head, and I think the strike is the only way to get the district to listen.
Tom, I appreciate it. Thanks. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Rocio in Highland Park. You're on AirTalk.
Hi, hello. I'm an LAUSD parent, and I'm just want to call and let you know that I support our teachers, and my son and I will be picketing right alongside the teachers come a strike, and that I'm just appalled by the district comportment towards the negotiations with UTLA and their misrepresentation of teachers.
So what do you have a specific issue you take with how the district has handled this?
Well, instead of actually doing something and looking for funding for our schools and going to Sacramento and actually doing their job, they're calling our teachers ineffective. They're attacking them. They're saying that they're doing this for money, and they're not looking at the overall issues of our public of our district, which my main concern is the continued privatization of the district and the continued growth of charter schools, and they're not addressing the millions of dollars that are being lost from the district because of charter school enrollment. So why are they not addressing that? So that's one of my main issues.
All right, Rocio, thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. The district, by the way, does have full-time lobbyists, I believe, in Sacramento who push for additional funding for schools. Plus, teachers' unions have a huge presence in Sacramento. They spend a lot of money lobbying the state legislature on additional federal funding for public education. Lindsay in Eagle Rock says, I'm an LAUSD parent. The best thing we can do is to support the teachers. They're fighting for our children and their education. Again, you can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We have just learned that UTLA has announced if an agreement cannot be reached by January 10th, then it will go on strike. So it again, the union saying it'll continue to negotiate, but if they do not make an agreement by January 10th, the union will go on strike. So that's the word from LA Unified. Coming up in our second hour, we'll be talking with union president Alex Caputo-Pearl. We'll talk with KPCC reporter Kyle Stokes, who was at the announcement by UTLA today. You'll hear that coming up in just a half hour. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with the police chief for Los Angeles, find out what Michael Moore has to say about the top issues in law enforcement. Once again, just want to let you know we'll have additional details about the contingent strike UTLA is calling. Should they not have an agreement by January 10th, teachers will walk off the job, and we'll have additional details coming up. But right now, we're joined by LAPD Chief Michael Moore. Chief, thank you so much for joining us again.
Good morning, Larry. Great to be here.
I'm just dumping this on you because it's just, you know, as we're speaking, this news is breaking. When you have labor action like this and likely, you know, large crowds, if this strike takes place January 10th, do you have to make specific plans of, you know, crowd control and deploying officers for that kind of action?
Absolutely. In fact, we're, you know, been monitoring this situation in the last couple of months, and we're working closely with our counterparts with the LA Unified School District Police, as well as the LA Unified School District Management, the superintendent, and UTLA and their leadership. We want to ensure that the safety of all, everyone, especially the kids, during this potential labor action, as well as facilitate the expression of UTLA and their members, as well as protect the rights of the district and the administrators. So
and
it's a balancing act.
How do you coordinate it? Because as you indicated, the district has its own law enforcement agency. So are they responsible for what happens on the campus and your officers responsible for what happens off the campus? How does that coordinate, or is it different every site?
Well, it's a unified manner. So what we do in policing and public safety today is it's not so much people looking at their turf. It's looking at what are the common goals and objectives, what are our strategies and tactics, and we talk and plan ahead of time. And we work regularly each day with LA Unified School District Police, as well as with the other agencies in the LA region. There's more than 650,000 young children and young adults that go to school each day, and their safety is all of our collective objective or goal, and how we deliver that is through coordinating our response and our services. So I look forward to those continued ongoing conversations. We're obviously watching today closely as well. And, you know, but I will say that this past Saturday, there was a UTLA demonstration, if you will, in the downtown area, very well attended, about 10,000 plus individuals. And we worked closely with the organizers, and I'm happy to report that the participants were followed the rules, if you will,
and teachers
expressed themselves within the boundaries of the law, and it was a very safe event. Now we also recognize there's always potential for individuals within the group or others to come and try to jump onto that and use it for their own nefarious purposes, but. Just to the public, I'll assure you that our conversations are ongoing and our planning will be to ensure the rights of everyone is protected, and certainly the safety of the children will be our most paramount concern.
We'll continue our conversation with Chief Michael Moore. He joins us regularly on Air Talk to discuss issues specifically related to the LAPD, but more generally in law enforcement as well. If you have a question for the chief, you can call 866-893-KPECC or post it on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. You can also tweet your question at Air Talk. We'll continue looking at some strategies streets in L.A. having higher speed limits so that police officers can do more speed enforcement. We'll talk about that. First time for a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Chief Moore and I just sort of catching up on our L.A. roots and L.A. background. As you've heard me talk many times, multi-generation Angeleno and my family going back deep. My LAPD homicide detective grandfather and my family going back in the area, as does Chief Moore. Welcome your calls if you have questions about law enforcement or about LAPD. AirTalk page, kpecc.org or 866-893-KPECC. Let's talk about traffic enforcement because there's kind of an oddity here that sometimes streets have to have higher speed limit set, according to state law, for there to be speed enforcement on those streets. So what does that mean for your officers now?
Well, it's we're hopeful that there's enough attention being brought to this today by our local legislators, as well as I'm hopeful of the state, to change the underlying law that identifies what the median speed is and how that median speed of a roadway influences and controls what is an allowable speed limit. And it has a tendency to drive those speed limits up. And the theory is I think, was relatively sound years ago in small municipalities that had speed traps, in which people would we'd go from a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit to a 25, and there'd be a person there with a radar gun, and they would that's how they'd maintain their revenues for the city. That's not the case here in Los Angeles. Our speed limits are meant to protect and save lives. And the way the current formula is made, it has a tendency to increase speeds based on what the average flow of a traffic is. And that average flow can be inflationary over time, people just keeping pace with the pace. So I'm hopeful that we're going to see a recalculation of that formula over time in this coming year. But in the midst of it, what it does allow by the city going out and our city council and finding the means of which to for DOT and for us to go out and do speed surveys is that our officers are going to be able to go out and use radar in lieu of having to pace individuals when they conduct speed enforcement. So what Angelenos can expect is that with this the recertifying of these streets across Los Angeles, that you're going to be able to see and you will see a greater level of motor officers and traffic officers engaged in speed enforcement relative to the use of radar in lieu of what previously we're having to rely upon, which was an officer estimating or an officer actually trying to pace an individual over a period of time.
Well, one of the complaints that we hear when we talk about driving issues on the program is what many see as a lack of enforcement when it comes to traffic violations. And of course, like, you know, it's always, where's a cop when you need him or her, when, you know, someone does an illegal move, sure, when you're out driving. Does this indicate that you are and your command staff are planning to assign more officers to traffic enforcement?
No, I think, and what I know is here in Los Angeles, we have more officers assigned to traffic enforcement per the ratio of our overall 10,000 sworn. We have nearly 700 officers assigned to traffic investigation and traffic enforcement. When you look across American policing, that type of dedicated set aside just doesn't exist. We're a rarity today. Generally, traffic enforcement is a responsibility of all members of the organization, and it is here in Los Angeles as well. Our rank and file officers working in black and whites engage in traffic enforcement as time allows, as resources allow. But we also set aside nearly 300 motor officers that their function is traffic enforcement. They do some collision investigation, but their primary role is traffic enforcement. And again, as you look at other agencies across California, across the United States, we are amply staffed there, and I'm just encouraged today that with the speed surveys being completed, the efficiency of our men and women operating those motor vehicles, operating the motors and the motorcycles and the black and whites, that can be more efficient in going out and identifying speeding motorists, violators, and conducting stops and taking enforcement action, versus what the previous tactics we had to rely on.
Sean in Los Feliz says, I'm concerned about distracted driving. I don't see much enforcement for drivers who are texting and other distractions. And you'd like to see, you know, more effort put into that.
Well, it's kind of interesting as you think about it, when you drive down the street and you see an officer conducting a traffic stop, you typically don't understand what enforcement action the officer is taking. So whether he's taking enforcement action for texting and driving or speeding or a right-of-way violation. So the idea that I don't see much of it, I don't disagree that as motorists and as pedestrians, we look around and we see people distracted both walking and driving as just a culture. And it's something that we have to change. In America, the technology has allowed us to increase our dangers in regards to traffic safety. While technology has improved engineering standards on roadways and on our vehicles, our own personal habits of how we take a cell phone and what we do with tablets and other devices, we've allowed those to take over our lives and become far too distracting as we're operating a motor vehicle or even simply walking down the street.
And I'm glad you brought up walking because we're all aware. I don't think anyone's going to argue against the fact that there are too many distracted drivers. But I don't hear as much conversation about distracted walkers. You know, one of the things that has puzzled me is why we have such a high pedestrian death rate compared to other cities, including those with many more pedestrians per capita. And my last visit to New York, I sort of spent time in Manhattan walking the street. And it was striking to me how different pedestrians are in New York. They're always assuming they're just, one step from being hit by a car and killed. They take all kinds of precautions. In Southern California, when people walk, they're oblivious half the time. So what is the way to sort of get L.A. walkers perhaps more wary and alert like New York walkers?
So I couldn't agree with you more. I live in the Hollywood area, and moving around the city, we continually see instances in which pedestrians have earbuds. They're looking at their phone, they're looking down, and they're walking even many times in a designated crosswalk, but they're not paying attention to their surroundings. And so they'll be in dark clothing, they'll be in unlit areas. They may or may not be in compliance with the traffic controls telling them not to walk and directing that there's a right turn lane there. And then that distraction, they really are risking their lives. We do have an education campaign. I'm proud of the work that we have where we've identified the issuance of traffic vests. They're yellow, highly reflective vests and a small LED light that we're going to be distributing, that we are distributing to motorists, to pedestrians as our officers go about their patrol and they take or initiate enforcement action. That enforcement action may be a citation, it may be a warning, but we're also giving them the officers the vest to hand out to have a moment of education and to let the pedestrian know that they have a shared responsibility in ensuring that their walk is safe. The fact that they're right in many times and where motorists are in the wrong and driving and posing an imminent risk to the pedestrian, I won't argue. The problem with that is that doesn't bring him back.
Yeah, it doesn't save your life, and it denies the reality that there are many drivers driving distractedly and not paying
exactly.
attention.
So more than half of our fatals, of our traffic fatalities, are pedestrians. A vehicle against a person is a no-win situation for the person. So, again, educating, and we have a defensive driving, we know, and we need defensive walking. This is not to forgive or to acquiesce to the fact that motorists have responsibilities, but our responsibility is for everyone involved.
Well, and you bring up defensive driving. For many of us of a certain age, that was part of our driver education classes, and the idea was it's not enough for you to drive legally. You've got to anticipate illegal or lazy actions of your fellow drivers. That's part of being a responsible driver.
2 points I want to identify, though. I want to do a shout-out to Farmers Insurance as well as AAA. Both those insurance groups have joined with us in pedestrian safety campaigns. The Farmers Insurance Group was the handing out of vests and these lights that I've talked about that campaign. And then in AAA, a couple months ago, we did a safe walk where they brought in 700-800 of their own employees along with community members in downtown Los Angeles and did a 3K walk just to recognize that what the pedestrians have a right to the roadways and to the sidewalks and to occupy those spaces, but they also have a responsibility to do so in a responsible manner.
We're talking with LAPD Chief Michael Moore. We'll continue our conversation. We'll talk about the challenge of illegal street racing in Los Angeles and surrounding communities. What's a way of dealing with that, particularly when they pop up through social media within minutes? You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. With us for his regular visit, LAPD Chief Michael Moore. If you have questions on law enforcement or LAPD, we're at 866-893-KPCC. The Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Street racing is an ongoing problem in Southern California, as well as a special stunt kind of automotive gatherings that can pop up spontaneously through social media. Chief Moore, what are the ways that the department is trying to deal with that hazard?
Well, it's multiple prongs. Enforcement certainly has a role. Recently, we've reorganized our traffic commands. I've talked about those resources that we talked earlier about, our pedestrian safety and our speed law enforcement. But we've now reorganized our traffic commands into a street racing task force posture where we are regularly monitoring social media and actors, players that we know that are engaged in this activity across the entire region. It's unfortunate, but this is a phenomenon that has resurged. It had a period of time where it began to lessen and become more dormant. It has now come back at it with a vengeance. It's utilizing technology that allows people to put scouts and be aware of where law enforcement's at. But the crowds have also become more volatile and less respectful of law enforcement's presence as well as fire. And so what we're taking is a posture that we will. As their tactics have become more sophisticated, so are ours. We're using our surveillance capabilities with airships to move across areas quickly to see where these groups are gathering and mustering their show, if you will. And then we're bringing enforcement actions in to hold people accountable, including spectators. We're looking to our legislators to hold accountable people who modify their street legal vehicles, to hold street racers as a practice, to hold the vehicle operator more accountable by potentially losing their vehicle, by bringing it back into conformance with EPA requirements. The other thing we're doing is we're reminding these enthusiasts that there are venues in which they can operate. There's places here in Irwindale that allows street racers to go and take their vehicle and have fun with it in a responsible way. I'm proud of some work by some off-duty officers up in the northern part of San Fernando Valley this last week, where they had a go-kart place where, you know, race a cop, if you will, in an effort to have that adrenaline rush and have that fun, but to do it in a manner that's responsible. Too many fatalities, too many loss of life has occurred as a result of these reckless actions.
I'm of the age where my uncle, when he was a teenager, raced at the old Lions mm-hmm. drag strip in Orange County. And there were a bunch of these drag strips around Southern California. You'd even see middle-aged guys with the family station wagon out, racing against each other for fun. And is that something where you think the city could create more of those spaces? Yes, there's Irwindale, but that's been under threat of closure, of having more places where people could safely race.
Well, I believe that it's interesting. This is an economy where people are investing tens of thousands of dollars in these vehicles. These are not vehicles that are just, it's not your family station wagon of days gone by. So I would look to the enthusiasts, if you will, to play a role in this responsibility. Government doesn't have a role to fix every problem. And I don't know that with our sparse resources that trying to identify a venue, a publicly operated venue for this type of conduct, I would rather look to the enthusiasts and encourage them to how do they mature into a responsible venue, responsible display and use of the technology, rather than right now looking for what they believe is a sparsely
some industrial stretch. Yeah.
And what we're finding at these locations is not just spectators, but others, innocent bystanders and others are being caught up in and losing their life or being seriously injured.
Brenda in Glendale says, I drive the freeways daily. I see the same cars doing the same things, driving super fast, weaving in and out, abusing the carpool lanes. And I don't see enforcement. She's prompting about CHP in that case, of course. But why can't we have drones, she says, observe. And you mentioned using airships, helicopters, sure, for spontaneous racing. Are drones something you consider in the mix, or with civil liberties concerns, is that not going to happen?
I don't see the value of that today. I don't believe the technology is there. I don't think society, particularly in Los Angeles, is ready for a RoboCop. The reality is that we do have, on freeways and fast track lanes and so forth, technology that captures absconders, people who aren't complying with the law. And I see CHP officers regularly taking enforcement action against speeding motorists, aggressive driving, and people who are violating the carpool lane, just as our men and women are taking action on the street. The reality is there's nothing more frustrating than as you're driving is to see someone endanger your safety or perhaps a child that's with you. I can just assure members of the public and will that our men and women are out there. They are taking enforcement action when they see these these violations as time allows and as they can. And it is it is something that we take seriously.
What's the latest crime figures, and particularly homeless Angelenos? Because I know there had been a spike in crime against unhoused residents.
So we are ending the year with an overall reduction in both violent and property crimes. I'm proud of the work of our men and women. I'm proud of just inheriting this agency. There's a lot's gone on this year with my appointment. But Chief Beck, under his leadership, a number of years ago, put in some strategies to impact particularly the increase that we'd seen in shooting violence and in homicides. And I'm proud to see that we were able last year to reduce that. And this year, we're going to end up with a reduction in both number of homicides, particularly gang-related homicides, as well as shooting victims. And also achieve reductions in other Part 1 crimes. I believe the success of that is both the strategies of LAPD and our men and women, as well as our partnerships in our communities and all the stakeholders in regards to what makes Los Angeles safe. Now, with that is this issue of homelessness. And in that, there's been some, you know, more recently now we're looking at homelessness, which is a humanitarian crisis of our generation, and saying, how are they being victimized? How are they at risk? What is their vulnerability? That's an area that we're now capturing that 5 years ago we didn't. And so we most recently had a report yesterday that talked about an increase in the number of victims as well as individuals we're arresting who identify themselves as experiencing homelessness. A caveat I would give to the public is I believe that the overall decrease in crime is outstanding. And this area of this increase is referenced maybe more of an awareness of their role than an actual increase itself.
Chief Moore, thanks so much. We appreciate your being with us again. Look forward to your next visit.
Thank you.
Michael Moore, LAPD Chief. Also speaking of homelessness, the federal government has done a census of homelessness across the U.S. Coming up, we put a panel of housing experts together. Talk about those results. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Hope your day is going well and always appreciate your listening. Whether it's to 89.3 or listening around the world on the KPCC app or at kpcc.org. Coming up later this hour, a bit of good news about homelessness in Southern California. A new federal census shows making some progress, particularly when it comes to families without a place to live. But we're going to talk with the experts because they've got all the subtleties and the day-to-day experience of working with those who are unhoused in Los Angeles. That's coming up a little bit later. Also, how colleges are helping their students deal with failure and to embrace failure as a necessary part of resiliency and ultimate success. But first, anything but success in solving the dispute between the LA Unified School District and United Teachers Los Angeles, the union representing rank-and-file teachers. UTLA just holding a news conference within the past hour, and KPECC education reporter Kyle Stokes was there. Kyle, share with us what came out of the news conference.
Yeah, Larry, the union has officially called for a strike to begin on January 10th if there is no agreement by then. And the union also said that they are not going to go back to the bargaining table unless the district comes back with a much better offer, a much improved offer that actually addresses, in the union's view, some of the substantive issues that the union has had on the table for many months. They feel like Superintendent Austin Buettner has reduced the issues at stake down to only salary. And obviously the fact finder yesterday saying that the union should accept the fact finder's offer of 6%, which is what the district had been offering. But the union says not only do they have issues related to class sizes and staffing levels for nurses, counselors, librarians, but a whole other host of issues about how schools are governed. For instance, teachers being able to vote anytime a school converts into a school of choice, and just a whole laundry list. 21, in fact, articles are under negotiation, and they don't feel like the district has taken seriously any of them. And so they've set a strike date, and they have not called for resuming negotiations at this point. They're saying the district knows where we are. Give us a call. Come back with a better offer.
All right. With us, President of United Teachers Los Angeles, Alex Caputo-Pearl. Thank you, sir, for being with us. First of all, on the salary issue, is the union agreeing to the 6% increase?
Thanks for having me. No, we're not agreeing to that. And one of the big problems here is that Austin Buettner continues to bargain in bad faith. He put out a press release yesterday saying that we had agreed to a salary that we just had not agreed to. So we're actually going to file another unfair practice charge for his lie on that. No, we haven't agreed. And frankly, the issues are much larger than that. We have to reduce class size. We've got to get more nurses and counselors into our schools. We've got to reduce standardized testing so that we can get music and the arts and ethnic studies back into the curriculum. So this is about a much broader fight to make sure that we've got a thriving, healthy school district that serves all kids.
So the independent fact finders, they came back with the 3% plus 3%. Why do you disagree with their finding that that was fair?
The fact finder's report is not a proposal, first of all. It's just an observation and something that can help move things if possible. They agreed with us on three fundamental things. One, they agree that the district has an almost $2 billion reserve. The fact finder agreed on that. Second, the neutral fact finder agreed that Section 1.5 needs to be removed from the contract, which is the section that allows the district to indiscriminately blow through class size caps to the detriment of students and educators. So they agree that we need to reduce class size. And third, the neutral fact finder agreed that we need common sense increases to staffing, like nurses, counselors, school psychologists. And frankly, the neutral fact finder also agreed that there needs to be more regulation on how co-located charter schools treat neighborhood schools when those charter schools go on to neighborhood school campuses.
So you're looking for the district to put that in a proposal form as opposed to you responding to what the fact finders reported?
The district hasn't offered any of those things. The last time we heard from the district in terms of a proposal was on October 30th when they sent us a one-page document that proposed increasing class size and then proposed to actually allow more ways for class size caps to be violated. So we have not gotten a proposal from the district in some time.
All right. Back to the salary issue, though, the fact finders, that's the only neutral party we have who's extensively studied it. What's keeping you from accepting the 3% plus 3% for that portion of the dispute?
Well, there's two things. One, there's some conditions on that are unacceptable. The district proposal has our members working more for a salary increase that they have more than earned over the last years. But secondly, we're not just going to agree on salary and leave every other issue out to dry. This is a fight for the future of public education. Are we going to allow an investment banker with no education experience to hoard a $2 billion reserve and say that we need to cut and privatize, or are we going to spend that reserve and also fight at the state level to invest in class size reduction, counselors, nurses, music, the arts, et cetera? That is what this fight is about.
I want to ask you about the getting the state to invest, because teacher unions in California spend a bunch of money lobbying the state legislature. School districts have lobbyists up there. What are you talking about? Because it seems to me like public education interest groups are one of the biggest influencers of Sacramento policy.
Well, two things. Just to finish what I was saying, we're not going to agree on salary and leave all of those other crucial issues for students and parents on the table. So on the issue of the state, Austin Buettner has been saying a lot that the teachers union and our parent allies and student allies, many of whom were out marching with us, with over 50,000 people marching through downtown L.A. on Saturday in support of common sense proposals like we're putting forward. He's often said they should not be focused on LAUSD. Their demands should be focused on the state, and let's work together at the state level. The fact is that we have been relentless at the state level. In fact, UTLA is part of a broad coalition that got the schools and communities first ballot measure on the ballot for 2020. It's the first measure to qualify for 2020, which would close the corporate property tax loophole within Proposition 13 and bring $5 billion additional dollars into our schools. So we've been relentless working at that, plus trying to pass legislation. The fact is that Austin Buettner at the state level needs to turn his rhetoric into actual work. He, as an investment banker and private equity manager, he has unique ties to Sacramento interest groups that typically oppose tax increases on the rich. He should be going and getting those groups of people together to make sure that we've got more money for our schools from Sacramento.
Given the majority of the legislature in Sacramento, hard to believe that those interest groups would actually stop increases unless they would be worried about a backlash, because you've got a super majority now of Democrats in the state legislature. So with this deadline coming up January 10th, if there's not agreement, you're going to call for all teachers to step out. Are you concerned about the potential ADA state funding hit that the district could take from that, and that could further reduce what's available to teachers?
So January 10th is our strike date that we announced today. And what we're most concerned about, yes, if we have to strike, and it will be a strike, if we have to strike, it's going to be with the parent and student and community support that we saw on Saturday with thousands in the street. If we have to strike, it will be a temporary disruption. But the thing that we're more concerned about is the last 25 years of disruption, where we've got the highest class sizes in the state, where we've got 80% of our schools without a full-time nurse, 40% of our schools with a nurse only one day a week. We're concerned about that 25-year disruption to kids and families, more so than a temporary disruption, and that's why we're willing to make this sacrifice if we have to.
Alex Caputo-Pearl, thank you for joining us and sharing UTLA's position heading into whatever negotiations occur between now and January 10th. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Also, I just want to mention that we invited L.A. School Superintendent Austin Buettner to join us. He was not able to join us on the program today. We hope to have him on very soon on Air Talk, providing the district perspective on the impasse. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Coming up, we'll take a look at just a wee bit of what appears to be incremental headway against homelessness in Southern California, but we'll talk about where some of the progress is being made and where problems just continue to be difficult to be able to make headway. We'll continue in 1 minute on Air Talk. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Well, for once, we get a bit of good news. The Federal Housing Urban Development Department, with its annual homeless assessment report, showing just a touch of increase in getting people into housing in Southern California, and some big gains being made in families. The homeless rate for families dropping 25%, but you've still got a remarkable statistic that of the chronically homeless, these are the people who are most difficult to meet their needs and the wraparound services that they require. California has half of the chronically homeless Americans. That is just an astonishing number. So with us to talk about the very latest in these numbers, where progress is being made and where things are very stubborn to try and deal with the problem, the head of the Los Angeles Homeless Authority, LASA, Peter Lynn. Peter, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Larry.
So your thoughts on what the HUD survey shows, the good and the continuing challenge.
So fortunately for the nation, HUD does pull information from every community on the annual homeless count and looks at that and gives us an opportunity to compare what's happening in the various regions. And so we look at this data as a comparison. When we look at the Los Angeles continuum of care, we did see decreases in the number of family members, which is essentially persons in households. And we also saw a marked decrease in homeless veterans. And I think, you know, that does suggest resources really matter. Those two populations have some more resources addressing them, particularly on the veteran side. But it also does, we are facing in Los Angeles and the Los Angeles region a significant crisis in housing affordability that is ongoing, and that's putting a lot of pressure on Angeleno households. We saw a modest decrease in the number of persons experiencing homelessness across the county, across the region. I think that's encouraging. It does show that some of the Measure H service provision that started last year and is continuing this year is making headway. But we do have a significant problem with housing affordability here.
Peter Lynn of LASA, the LA Homeless Services Authority, with us. Also joining us from the Union Rescue Mission, a Christian nonprofit homeless shelter in downtown Los Angeles, the largest of its type, CEO Andy Bales. Andy, good to have you with us.
Good
again.
To have you.
So your thoughts about this and just what you're seeing at on Skid Row where you're located.
So what we're seeing is overwhelmingly more numbers of people, I used to say experiencing homelessness, but now I say devastated by homelessness. And it's no surprise that we have by far the vast amount of people suffering from chronic homelessness, because the longer you leave people on the streets and the more people you leave on the streets, the more devastated people are by homelessness. And at this time of saying we're making some improvement on family homelessness, Peter knows there was a point about a month ago where every hotel room available in every spa was at capacity of when we placed people into hotels. At the same time, Union Rescue Mission's fourth floor was full. Our fifth floor, a brand new fifth floor for families, was full. And we had 150 moms and kids in our gym for the first time ever. And when I made a big deal about that in the news, what happened? Did we take emergency steps to deal with it? No. 211 began to quit referring families to Union Rescue Mission and began referring families to living in their cars in parks. And I have solid evidence of that, and I have raised a ruckus this past week about that. So you don't solve homelessness by announcements or by marketing or by placing a small structure up and holding a press conference. We will solve this by declaring the FEMA-like Red Cross disaster that it is when you have 40,000 precious souls living on the streets of Los Angeles. It is an absolute disaster, and you can account for any reduction by just margin of error, right? You take account 1 year, you take account the next year, the margin of error could be 3 to 5%, right? And what was the reduction? It's less than 3 to 5%. So we in no way should be declaring any victory.
Why, it is, though, the HUD census, if I'm not mistaken, showed a 14% increase the previous year. So, I mean, that is progress beyond the margin of error.
That is progress to stem the tide, although it's a little bit like saying that Measure M's starting to make an impact on our traffic, right? Even though it takes an hour and a half to drive to work instead of an hour, because evidence from what we see on the streets, and I'm saying every neighborhood, from every neighborhood, evidence of what we see on the streets and what I experience every day on the streets is that homelessness is increasing in LA. And we know more people are falling into homelessness every year than we're getting out. As good as Measure H is, as good as Measure HHH is, as good as LOS is doing, as good as everybody's doing, we know with the skyrocketing rents, more people are falling into homelessness than we're getting out. So I just want to, you know, I talked to city council last month, and I said, you know, the other night a 26-year-old woman ran into our building naked, beat, and raped, and we called the medics, we called the police, we covered her in clothes, and I said, I can't take living in a city. My heart can't take living in a city where that's the reality. And I just ask humbly if we could hold off celebrating or patting ourselves on the back or holding press conferences until we do something significant about this emergency.
Andy Bales with us. Union Rescue Mission, Skid Row, downtown Los Angeles, coming up. We'll get a sense of what's happening in Orange County from the executive director of Mercy House, which has a number of homeless facilities in Orange County. Larry Haynes to be with us. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC if you want to join our conversation. If you're in homeless services, I welcome your input at 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back in 1 minute. We're talking about the latest numbers on the homeless crisis in Southern California. We're talking with Peter Lynn of the L.A. Homeless Services Authority, Andy Bales of the Union Rescue Mission, and Larry Haynes, executive director at Mercy House, which is headquartered in Santa Ana. Larry, thank you for being with us.
Morning.
What are you seeing in Orange County, particularly several months now after the clearing of the encampments along the San Gabriel River?
So what I heard earlier in the conversation was we have Peter who's saying the data shows that there's, you know, some improvement. Andy bringing a street level of view that shows something, you know, quite different than that. So I guess I'm going to be the center guy and say that both kind of sort of are right. And it's not terribly uncommon to have a distinction between what sort of the research and the data will show and maybe what some of the street experience is. In Orange County in particular, is somewhere there in the middle. We actually showed a small increase in homelessness over the last year of about 3.4%. Now, I'd also agree with what was said earlier by Andy that when you see a small deviation like that, that could be relevant to so many different things. It could be the time of day. It could be your methodology is different, the number of volunteers you have out on the street. So I think what we are seeing in Orange County, and I think generally speaking across the country, this holds true, we're basically holding serve. Right. There is some improvements here, some stepping back elsewhere. But I think that I think it is probably fair to say the data shows kind of a holding serve. And I agree that is nothing to celebrate. We certainly need to do better.
And what's the progress, Larry, on the regional homeless shelters that each community is supposed to provide? And there was so much pushback against the County Board of Supervisors establishing those.
Right. Well, I was sort of in the middle of that. We operate a lot of those. And so I've sort of been in the middle of a lot of those animated, shall we say, community meetings. Honestly, in Orange County, I think we're doing well. I think we're making some real progress. Now, I admit I tend to be bullish on these things. My nature is to be optimistic. But we've got four key things that are happening in Orange County right now that have me optimistic. One, we've greatly improved our outreach. both ourselves and a group such as CityNet, for example, is out on the streets making really great contacts. And I don't think solid outreach could ever be undervalued or ever overvalued. It's a big deal to create that relationship. Larry, you'd mentioned that there are several shelters being built. We have bridges at Kramer Place in Anaheim. The city of Santa Ana, it took us 28 days to open up a 200-bed shelter in Santa Ana called The Link, which is spectacular. Buena Park has something on the books. And I also want to reference the original one down in Laguna Beach that is run by the Friendship Shelter. And in particular, Don Price has been a leading advocate in our emergency shelter movement to make sure that we stay housing-centric, housing-focused. We also have several permanent supportive housing projects online. We've developed one that's become something of a landmark called The Orchard. Pathways of Hope in Fullerton is developing a new one as well. And I think probably all the guests would agree that the end game really is in permanent housing. And what we have in Orange County right now is a combination. United Way is leading some of this effort. I know they've been on these airwaves to talk about this. There's a group of us that are trying to put together 2,700 units of permanent supportive housing. All of this, or much of this, is being guided with an investment by the County of Orange and their care provider, Susan Price. And I think we are unified. I think we're strategic. And I think in Orange County, we are going to see some real results.
One of the things that strikes me is just how great the need is for supportive services. We spend so much time talking about housing. Obviously, that's a huge issue with rents being what they are. But do we have enough trained people to provide the services for the thousands of people who are dealing with drug addiction, with psychological challenges, with the despair? Do we have that kind of person power?
So again, I think I'm probably in the middle of the panel here. I'm going to say yes and no, but I really want to emphasize housing. Housing is magic. Magic happens in housing. And yes, services are important. And yes, we need to do everything we can to make sure that people are sustained. But let me just give you some examples from Mercy House. Over the last 5 years, our statistics indicate in our permanent supportive housing projects, where the emphasis has been more on housing than services, roughly 4% of those folks that in a five-year span have returned to homelessness. I mean, come on, guys, that's good stuff. Over a five-year period, housing works. Housing works for those that are addicted. Housing works for those that are disabled. And I would simply suggest this. I am a believer in services, and I'm a believer in housing stabilization. And I also think that it's better to be sober than addicted. I also think it's better to work than be unemployed. But let me ask your audience this. Where do you think you are more likely to experience that success, operating from your apartment as a platform or a bush?
All right. Andy Bales, your thoughts on that and the degree to which we can provide those services.
I agree with Larry, but I know he's had a lot of supportive services in order to have those kind of results. And in L.A., we have 40,000 people on the streets. And we can't just wait for housing to come at $550,000 per unit. We will never get there. So a great philosophy, but it doesn't work as a strategy for ending homelessness in Los Angeles to merely do housing at $550,000 per unit per person to end the homelessness of 40,000 people. So we were told by the Urban Institute that we need to create 60 structures, four in each district, and for 100 people in each, right? And we needed to put up structure, shelter, bridge housing, call it what you want, immediately. And if we put up 64 in each district, we could get 13,000 people off the streets in a year. And here we are a year later. We chose to put one structure, emergency or bridge housing, in each district, 15 total. I think we have one or two up after a year, 45 in the first one, 45 bunks, 30 for men, 15 for women. That will not get us there. First of all, we needed to follow the instruction of experts and put 60 emergency structures up. We didn't follow the advice. We're planning on 15. It took us a year to put up one. We're not treating it like the emergency it is. And the longer we leave those 40,000 people on the streets, the more devastated for life they're going to be. We are harming their educational hopes. We're harming their vocational hopes. We're destroying their souls. Last night, several women on the streets were attacked, assaulted. And as long as we leave precious human beings to be treated like that, we are not living up to our name, the City of Angels. We are falling so far short, and it needs to be treated like the disaster that it is.
Michael in Alhambra asks, what's available in the way of substance abuse treatment for homeless Southern Californians? I mean, are there spots that they can get free treatment?
There are spots, but they're not nearly enough spots. So we have a recovery program, 1-year recovery program for men on our third floor at Union Rescue Mission. Some of the other missions also have recovery. There are other programs like Acton that are sponsored by the state and county, but there's not nearly enough, and addiction is driving a lot of people, if not into their homelessness, it's keeping them locked on the streets.
We're talking with Andy Bales, Union Rescue Mission, Larry Haynes, Mercy House in Orange County, and Peter Lynn, who's head of the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. Peter, let me come back to you, because you heard a lot from our two in-studio guests here, and your thoughts about, you know, what it is going to take to have the kind of impact Andy Bales just talking about.
So obviously we need to ramp up services across the board, and there have been enormous increases in outreach workers. There have been enormous increases in housing placements. We put more than 16,500 people into housing last year, and it's not new construction. Some of, you know, we do need to construct more permanent supportive housing. Los Angeles needs more affordable housing across the board, and that's going to take housing at all levels. But with that was largely using subsidies in the rental markets, including long-term permanent supportive housing rental subsidies, the way that Larry referenced. Some of those are in ordinary rental market, and short-term rental subsidies. Some people just need, you know, temporary assistance and can get back on their feet. But we've hired more than 1,500 supportive service workers, outreach workers, housing navigators, folks in positions to get folks assistance, and, you know, ramping that up. Recruiting is a challenge. We've hired recruiters in each service planning area of the spot to contribute to that, and they are already helping to bring more services to bear. But it is going to take a complete, well-rounded service offering. We need outreach workers. There are, as Andy points out, there are large numbers of people on the street. We need a thoroughgoing coordination on the outreach side, and we have more than 600 teams out there working to deliver outreach and get people enrolled in services and get people pulled into housing. We need interim housing, shelter. There are more shelters that are being stood up, and we've funded more of those. We need short-term rental assistance for people who can get back on their feet, and we need long-term rental assistance. So there's a multi-pronged approach. Measure H has funded each of those strategies, but we're going to have to expand all of them.
Peter Lynn, thank you so much. Andy Bales, I appreciate your coming in. Larry Haynes, thank you for coming in as well. And we appreciate also the work that all three of you are doing on this critical service and need here in Southern California. Rob writes on the page, I work at a sober living facility in Orange County. Some of the clients were lucky enough to get funded by nonprofits so they could deal with their addiction and homelessness. It's amazing when a person has a bed and a room and a meal that they can go to every night and then see how much they're willing and want to give up their substance abuse and become a contributing person in our society. That's Rob writing on the Air Talk page. We have much more conversation to come on Air Talk after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. You know, there's a lot of pressure on kids today when they're in high school, even before that, to try and be as perfect as possible when it comes to their grades, extracurricular activities. And taking risks and failing isn't exactly touted as a way to success or being recognized for one's accomplishments. Well, there are some universities who are trying to counter that. They're actually offering courses and workshops in failure. Vanderbilt University, Princeton, a number of other schools are helping their students, at least trying to become more resilient and understand that failure is a part of living a holistic life, and that if you don't suffer setbacks, if you don't have failures, then you're probably not trying enough different things and you're not putting yourself out there. I'm always struck by people who have made some of the biggest contributions to our lives, to our country, are people who've had multiple, not just setbacks, but spectacular failures along the way to whatever the breakthrough is that they've made. With us to talk about whether that sort of resiliency is teachable or inborn is Melissa Korn, Wall Street Journal reporter who covers higher education. Melissa, share with us, first of all, about what appears to be a growing trend. How many schools are starting to take this up?
So I, in my story, feature about a half dozen schools that are doing this, and it's really a wide range from University of Montana to Bentley in Massachusetts to, as you mentioned, Vanderbilt and Princeton. So it's not just the schools that people might immediately assume are catering to affluent, kind of fragile students, as the assumptions are these days, but really students from all walks of life, growing up in a world with these seemingly perfect curated social media feeds that their peers have, and just this idea that mom and dad have for years come and helped protect them, it really leaves them heading into college not totally sure how to cope when they get a bad grade or a breakup or just something bad happens.
Are any of the schools aware that there is sort of a contradictory message here? Because for so many of them, as you just suggest, they're making their selection process based on this sort of perfection or this sort of, you know, very high GPA, high test scores, not having some sort of, you know, significant setback when in high school. That then to turn around and talk about, oh, yes, it's important that you try things and be willing to fail and be resilient, that kind of goes against their whole process of who they choose.
You know, when I spoke to some administrators and counseling staffers about this at the schools, they do acknowledge that, you know, that most of these students got there because they hadn't failed before. But the college experience just is different than high school. This is the first time a lot of these kids are on their own. And the coursework is different. The expectations are different. So one of the things they do to try to counter that seeming dissonance is they bring on stage at some of these workshops, the president of the university or a top administrator or that favorite professor to talk about things that they did, you know, failures that they had and what they learned from them. So not just, hey, I failed. Yay, everyone, this is great. But I failed. Here's what I learned. The next time I tried, I did this instead, and here's where I am now.
We're talking with Melissa Korn, Wall Street Journal reporter, just wrote a very interesting piece for the journal titled Failure 101, Colleges Teach Students How to Cope with Setbacks. Also with us from Yeshiva University of Los Angeles Boys High School, Director of Innovation, Rabbi Michael Cohen. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how do you work with this with your students at Yeshiva in the high school when they're obviously looking to get accepted to highly selective colleges?
You're right. It's a college prep school, but the administration brought me on a year ago to actualize a vision where entrepreneurial thinking and practice should be part of the academic experience. And the way that I've designed the course is that the unknown and the experiences of failure are part of what could potentially result in incredible successes.
And how do you encourage this and also, you know, distinguish between failure from a lack of effort and failure from trying something that might have a high risk to it, but a big reward and helping the students, you know, take some of those on?
So the notion of failure, for me, I've come to realize, and I spent the better part of the past 2 years writing a book that will be published in the beginning of 2019. And one of the chapters dedicated to failure is that failure is a stop on a journey and not a destination. And so because school is designed to be compliance-based and it's convergent thought process-based, so there is one answer. And so if you fail a quiz or you fail a course, that really is game over. And so what we need to do is for the students that go through this K-12 process, they need to have an enriched experience that while we can still value these incredibly rigorous and challenging honors AP course and college prep style education, they need that chance to really figure out and develop problem-solving skills that, you know, in the book, the two quotes that really stuck out for me to begin that chapter, one is from Proverbs. It says, you know, the righteous falls down seven times and gets up. And the second quote is from Thomas Watson, which is, the way to succeed is to double your failure rate. Now, the reason for these quotes is that this isn't an isolated experience. They both represent an end goal of greatness. And if we allow our students to go down a path, even if it's in just a couple days a week elective, where they're really trying to identify what problems are out there and what skills they need to solve them, and what does it look like to not succeed, reflect on that, and then to be able to launch from that failure your point to a greater success.
And the challenge, of course, can be in a child then dealing with parents who are disappointed when the child has setback. I mean, particularly, you've got parents who are paying, you know, good money to send their kids to your school. Part of that is maybe an expectation of high achievement coming out of it, and not an expectation of spectacular failure along the way to taking on risk. So do you help the boys at the school deal with parental disappointment?
Absolutely. But I do it in, a different angle. And that is that I try to show these students that many of these core literacies that they struggle with, many of these classes that they are taking in the humanities, the science, and the math, although they might not feel successful in them, many of the times it's because they're not sure of the purpose, or why should I invest more time and more work in this area when I don't feel that I'm really getting any real-world skills. So in the entrepreneurial program, and really this entrepreneurial approach that I see creeping up in different schools around the nation that I engage and work with in my travels, is if you help them build their resilience as a person trying to solve problems that provide value for others, they start to see and start to research. When I connect with a CEO on Twitter and show them that CEO of a company says the most important skill is strong writing and communication skills, because that will foster and enhance the visual and the verbal as well, all of a sudden now they're seeing, this isn't my English teacher saying this, although I think that they should appreciate the insights and the value that their teachers are trying to provide. It does offset that in a certain way. The other thing is getting students to really understand the power of technology and the power of the internet and the network of people in a positive to help with learning disabilities and struggles, more than many of the times, you know, the internet is painted as a place where you create your picture perfect life of no failures and only good things.
We're talking with Rabbi Michael Cohen, Yeshiva University of Los Angeles Boys High School. We're talking about helping students learn resiliency to deal with failure and to be able to emotionally accept that and not be deterred from taking risks and aiming high. Coming up, we'll talk with Smith College's Rachel Simmons. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is coming up in just a few minutes. Ben Taub of The New Yorker is going to talk about his reporting on the Iraqi government and its campaign of revenge against people it claims were associated with ISIS, including hundreds of thousands of civilians. That coverage from The New Yorker, Ben Taub with Terry Gross, coming up on 89.3 KPCC. We're talking about resiliency and coping with failure and embracing failure as a part of ultimate success in college and in high school. And from Smith College, leadership development specialist Rachel Simmons joins us. Thank you so much, Ms. Simmons. I wonder at Smith how you work with your students on this.
Sure. Well, as an educator, I'm really committed to teaching students the skills to manage failure. I mean, I think it's really important for them to hear stories about other people failing, and it's important for them to hear the message that they need to fail. But I think a lot of us, kind of the next question is, well, then how do you teach them to do it? What do you have a student say to themselves in the moment as they begin to face their fear? How do you teach a student to set a goal that is appropriate for their ability and is in the sweet spot between something that they're comfortable doing and something that terrifies them, such that they can take a risk and actually comfortably accomplish it? How do you teach a student to talk to themselves when they fail? For example, we know that young adults are notorious overthinkers. That's particularly true for girls and young women. And so teaching our students to recognize what's ruminating, what should you do when you start to feel yourself doing that? How does it undermine your motivation? How can you talk to yourself differently? So we're working on the mechanics of what you do in that moment, as well as how do you change your mindset.
I love your dealing with brain development as a part of this process, because it's huge. The things that young people are going through, the sorts of self-doubts, negative self-talk, that even seemingly the most secure of students have to deal with.
I think we all deal with it. And so, for example, one of the things that I teach my students to do, and this really comes from Buddhism as much as anything, is we all have a voice that, for example, might say, you don't belong here. You're an imposter. You're not smart enough to be in this class. Or you're not smart enough to apply for that job or that internship. We all have that voice, but that doesn't mean you have to listen to it, and it doesn't mean you have to identify with it. You have to recognize we all have it. You have to learn to distract yourself, to talk back to it. But that's what we mean when we're talking about the skills to be resilient in the face of failure. And I think a lot of students are craving that right now.
So many young people now are really creatures of a highly socialized social media world, and it reinforces notions of judgment, critique, and labeling failure. So how do you work with, and it's both young women and young men, how do you help them deal with the fact that they may find themselves alone with thoroughgoing criticism when they take a risk and don't succeed?
It's a great question, and I think it's important to remind listeners that this generation of young people is the most lonely generation we've ever had on record. In other words, they actually, a study came out this year that found that college-age individuals, ages 18 to 22, said they were lonelier than the elderly, which is pretty crazy.
Wow.
When you think about how it's often, in some ways, the job of a young adult to, like, hang out with their friends. But what that means is that there is a lot of solitude, and that's exacerbated by social media. So we talk to our students a lot about how do you ask for help, and how do you ask for help not when you're having a meltdown, which unfortunately is when a lot of college students surface to us. How do you ask for help when you detect that you just might need to seem a little bit less than perfect to your friends, and why that's actually going to help you be a more effective worker and a more effective learner? A lot of our students either ask for help too much or they don't ask for it at all. So teaching support seeking is another really critical skill to deal with some of that loneliness and to make it easier to be vulnerable with your peers.
Are there exercises you can do to help students experience what's that like? I don't know whether it be role playing or sort of, you know, sitting with certain feelings, but is there a way that you can actually use group experience to help develop that?
Oh, 100%. I mean, what I always say to my students is you can practice anything you want to get better at. And a couple days ago, I had a student sitting in my office, and she actually needed to ask a professor for an extension. This is finals time. And so she just was terrified to do that and imagined, if I do this, the professor will think I'm stupid or incapable. And we had a conversation, well, if you don't do this, what's going to happen? So it's important for her, that student, and for many other students to understand that rather than asking for help being something that undermines your ability, it's actually something that makes you more successful. And you're more employable, and I really think this is true, when you're willing to say, I don't have all the answers, I need help with something. And so those are the kinds of interactions that are very, I think, intimate with students, but actually make a real difference in the way that they navigate their challenges.
Silverio writes on the AirTalk page, resiliency can certainly be taught. The Army has a program specifically directed at soldiers who've experienced traumatic events in combat or other stressors in life. The program's designed to teach soldiers skills exhibited by resilient people and to help the soldiers be flexible, teach them to rebound from the situations that could be detrimental to their lives. That's Silverio writing on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Robert in El Camino Village, welcome.
Hi, guys. I currently am involved with an LA Unified School District program at certain middle schools where there's a higher population of single-parent, foster-parent-type children on teaching them life skills. And I always let them know, aside from everything else we're going to cover this year, that I'm going to try and hopefully teach them to fail well. And I, get very puzzled looks from them. But this is building off my retired career in high-tech electronics. We have to take risks. And of course, in their concern about, what's this about failure? I said, well, look, you know how to fail well because you learned how to walk and you learned how to ride a bicycle and some of these simple things in life. And you did that by building and building. And so I try and guide them. I let them know I'm not going to put you at risk, but let's kind of stretch things a little and let's keep our peripheral vision open so that if something along the way doesn't work out, well, maybe that's an avenue to a whole different thought.
Robert, I appreciate your call. Thank you so much. And I want to thank our guests who've talked about how schools have formalized ways of teaching or workshopping with students, building their tolerance for failure, building resiliency to be able to handle setbacks that are going to happen if you're taking risks and you're trying new things. My thanks to Wall Street Journal reporter Melissa Korn, who wrote a very good piece about this for the Journal, titled Failure 101. My thanks to Rabbi Michael Cohen, Director of Innovation at LA's Yeshiva University of LA Boys High School, and Rachel Simmons, Smith College Leadership Development Specialist. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next on 89.3. From all of us, have a great afternoon. I'm back with you tomorrow morning at 10.